Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's good to be here. It's been a few weeks since I've been here, and it's really good to be back. It is an exciting weekend, and not the least part of which is that we add about 20-plus new members to the Dallas congregation, at least for 9 months. Some of you will probably stay permanently. That happens every year. So that's great. We're glad to have you. One of the things you're going to learn at FI, probably, I believe, second semester when you get into the book of Daniel, is an understanding of four great empires that were prophesied through Daniel's image. One of them, the third one, was the Greek Empire, and in many respects, it was one of the most influential. Our Western civilization, as we know it today, was shaped and molded to a great extent by the elements of the Greeks and the Romans, and especially the Greeks in terms of education, philosophy, and government. We have a global reoccurring tribute to the influence of the Greek culture that's now unfolding. It happens every 4 years, and it's unfolding before the whole world on television and live, of course, in Rio de Janeiro, and that is the Olympic Games. It is a testimony to the influence of the Greeks that in the late 1800s, when a group of people decided to organize an international athletic contest, that they decided to call it the Olympics in honor of something that happened over 2,700 years previous. So the Olympics go way, way back. They began several hundred years B.C., and from what we know, the Greek, the peoples there in Greece, the entire culture was deeply enmeshed in these games. It was not only athletics, it was social and also religious events, the observance of these contests. By the mid-6th century B.C., there were four annual games that had become institutionalized. They were known as the circuit, four of these games. They were known as the Olympic, the Isthmian, that's a hard word to say, Isthmus, but it was the Isthmian Games, the Pythian, and the Nemean. They were four separate games, four separate areas, and they were held on alternating years, 2 or 4 year intervals, but they were arranged so there was at least one set of games every year throughout Greece. Now, unlike the Olympics today, as I mentioned, alluded to earlier, religion was heavily a part of these games because not only did they compete among themselves, but their desire was to bring glory to their gods. And there were different gods that were, as so often happened in the pagan world, that were influential or esteemed by different cities. The Olympic Games became the most important, and they are traditionally dated back to 776 B.C. They were celebrated in the town of Olympia every 4 years. In Greek chronology, it came to be that a four-year cycle came to be called an Olympiad. So when you hear about an Olympiad, it was not only just back then, it was a way of measuring time every 4 years. And they were held to honor Zeus. The Greeks actually claimed that they had mythological origins. And they were attended not only by the Greeks, but people from nations all over the cultured world came to observe the Olympic Games. The Isthmian Games were held to honor Poseidon, the god of the sea. The Pythian Games occurred at Delphi, and they honored Apollos, the Greek god of music, poetry, prophecy, and medicine. And the Nemean Games were held in a town called Argolis in honor of Zeus as well. When people came to these games, everything stopped across the country. And the games were not just athletic events. There were festivities. There were parties going on. It was a huge social occasion. Even during the Olympic Games, if there were wars going on, Sparta's fighting Athens again, something like that happening, they called what they had the Olympic truce, so that everything would stop and they could go play. And the soldiers were guaranteed safe passage to and fro. And then, of course, because of the competitions in that Greek culture, the games became a political tool used by city-states to be propaganda of their assertiveness over their opponents. Some things haven't changed, have they? It wasn't just athletics that was involved. Sculptors, poets, artisans from all over the country would come to the games to display their works. And sometimes poets would be commissioned to write songs or poems to honor some of the winners. But in the games themselves, as time developed, they all came to have the same contest. Some of the early games played were obviously foot races of different lengths. They had chariot races. They had the discus and other throwing events. They had jumping and leaping contest. As time went on, other games were added. They added boxing. They added wrestling. They added something called the pancration, which was a fighting competition that combined wrestling and boxing. And later the pentathlon. And then there was another contest that I want to comment on a little bit later. I'll save that. So what does all of this have to do with us today? Well, about 100 miles east of Olympia was a city named Corinth. The Isthmian Games were always held at Corinth because it is situated on an isthmus, a narrow neck of land. And it is further interesting that in 55 AD, that was the year for holding the Isthmian Games. And 55 AD is also the year that we understand Paul wrote his first letter to a small church in Corinth. It was a young church. It had been founded only 4 years previous, in 51 AD. And for the group of people there in the church, in their spiritual immaturity, they were having some serious problems. They were facing some big challenges that were dividing them to an extent that Paul had to get involved and write a lengthy letter. In 1 Corinthians, he sets the tone very early, and I suppose the core question that he addresses through the rest of the book is found in verse 13, when he asks a simple question: is Christ divided? Well, the rest of the book essentially answers it. No, obviously not. So then why are we? Why are we having all these things going on in the church, he was asking, and what do we need to do about it? Now, one of the ways that Paul addressed it was by weaving in some references to the athletic games that were going on, the classical games of the day. These were things that people could understand, and it probably resonated with them. I don't know about you. You may have no interest at all in the Olympics. My wife and I are sort of Olympic junkies. We sit down with our dinner and turn on the TV, and we want to see what's happening that night, and I usually stay up too late. And it's not just the events. Sometimes the most interesting things are the backstories to some of these people, people around the world and how they got to where they are. But I find it fascinating and very interesting as well. But you don't have to be an athlete. You don't even have to be interested in sports to sometimes be impressed and inspired by the examples of people who are in that realm of life and achieve in that way. On the other hand, you don't have to be an athlete to draw certain analogies about some terrible examples of the worst of human competition that can show up from time to time. We've already had some of those examples in this Olympics that's taken place. And that was what was taking hold in Corinth. It only took Paul 11 verses to get to this. When he gets right into his book, he jumps right in it, and he says in verse 11, I hear there are contentions among you. And it's true. There were wranglings, there were arguments, there was a competitive spirit at work. It was going so far that they were lining up behind various ministers. He addresses this. He said, every one of you says, well, I'm a Paul. I'm of Apollos, I'm of Cephas, and then the best ones were, well, I'm of Christ. They were probably the most righteous. But people were lining up and they were pitting ones against the other. And Paul essentially says, look, we are all acting so smart about this and so wise in our opinions. But you know what? That's not smart. In a culture that gloried. And understand, they were coming out of their culture. And it was a culture that gloried physically in the strong, the mighty, and the swift. And Paul later in chapter 1 says, that's not us. In a culture that gloried intellectually in the philosophers and the wise, Paul said, that's not us either. He said, God has called none of these types of people. He said, we're just not it. God has chosen foolish and weak and base of the world. And he says he did it for a very important reason, a very powerful reason, so that he who glories should glory in the Lord. They had grown up in a society that gloried in their heroes and in their gods. And he said, we're having to make a major shift here. There is a glory that needs to be dedicated to God. But it needs to be to the right God, not the ways of life that we are following. What we're doing here, he said, is not what God glories in or is glorified by. So the tone of the entire book is set here in chapter 1. We are here. We are here for an entirely different reason than the world around us is living for. Our values are different. Our goals are different. Our calling is different. We have to lift our eyes to a different way of living and then raise our conduct to match that, because we're wallowing around in the same way that the society around us is conducting itself, and we're not honoring God. The next two chapters emphasize worldly wisdom versus godly wisdom, and the fact that worldly wisdom will inevitably end up resulting in carnal, destructive division. He goes on in the next few chapters after that to address some of the things that in their wisdom they were allowing. They were allowing some horrific morality problems to just continue and to grow. They were taking their brothers to court. He had to explain principles, fundamental principles of marriage and sanctifying your spouse. They were divided over eating meats that had been sacrificed to idols. But the worst part of it was a lot of them didn't care whether their brother stumbled or not. There was not a concern for one another that way. And so we go through the letter and we come to chapter 9. And Paul speaks initially about how a Christian practices self-denial. Because when we start putting ourselves first, it always tends to be at the expense of someone else. And he offered himself as an example, and he wasn't boasting, but he just said, look, I am voluntarily refusing to take income from you. He had a legitimate right to it, but he said, I'm just not going to do it. I'll bear it some other way, but I will deny myself that way. By this point, he had laid the groundwork very well to bring them to a point of understanding that they needed to reconsider the course they were walking, and to bring them to an inspirational point of view that, look, we are on a course of life for something much greater than anything that the world offers. And there is only one thing that counts. And to make this point, he took them to understanding something they knew very well in their everyday life. These athletic Olympic games and the Isthmian games, the Grecian games. Some feel that it's very possible that Paul might have seen some of these games due to their popularity. And these weren't the only games throughout Asia Minor and the Middle East. There were other places that had them too. These were the big ones though. And personally, I expect that he had seen some of them, because you see very commonly in his writings sporting metaphors and analogies. He makes many references and allusions to this. So we come to verse 24. And we come here, and we need to consider this, not only looking at it as the Corinthian church, but putting ourselves into this picture because it was preserved for us. What is addressed here is clearly for all of God's people. 1 Corinthians 9:24. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run? Do you not know? He was really asking a rhetorical question. He wasn't expecting an answer because of course they knew. Everybody knew about racing. This was their culture. It was something with which they were very familiar. And he goes on to tell them, you need to consider yourselves as racers, as boxers even. We'll get to these points. But those who run in a race, that's a very interesting phrase. Those who run in a race. In a race in the Greek is the word en stadio, E-N-S-T-A-D-I-O, en stadio. Literally translated, we would call it in the stadium. In the stadium. Those who run in the stadium, the running ground, the race course. It comes from a word which means to place or establish, the root word. By this time, all of the games had established distances. The race courses were commonly just over 600 feet, roughly the length of 200 meters today, about an eighth of a mile. And racing was considered a virtue. Being fast, being swift, was considered culturally to be a virtue. We don't think of it so much as a virtue. We just think, well, they're physically gifted. But it was a virtuous thing to be fast. And athletes took great pains to excel in it and to train for it. So what was Paul talking about? Was he leading up to the fact that, you know, let's have church games. And we'll form a church track team. Well, obviously not. He was wanting them to consider a point. He wanted them to ask themselves, what is the race I'm in? What is the race? What are we racing for? As years go by, you come to see that people can race for very different things. I've seen people over the years who were really racing for prestige or power or influence. Is that what the race is all about? Money? Fame? Even the world has a phrase that we use today. We talk about, well, being in the rat race. I don't want to be in the rat race. As somebody said one time, they said, well, I guess that means that even if you win, you're still a rat. But we don't want to be in a rat race, do we? What are we racing for? What are you racing for? Who are we racing against? Why are we in this race? If we don't know what the race is for, if we're racing against the wrong competitors, or if we're unclear why we're doing it, we're going to have trouble finishing the race. So he goes on to say, those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize. Now for them, what were the prizes? What were they racing for back then? Well, the immediate prize, this is really great, folks. The immediate prize was to have a bunch of twigs and leaves put on your head. A wreath. They would make a wreath and you would get a wreath put on your head. You think, man, I worked 9 months for this wreath. It's a pretty lousy hat. Next week it's going to be dried and brittle and turning brown. And that was it. Well, symbolically it was much more. In the Isthmian games, it was a wreath made from pine branches. In the Pythian games, it was made out of laurel branches. You know what's interesting about that? It's from that wreath, the laurel wreath at the Pythian games, that we get the phrase today, somebody who's resting on their laurels. That's where the phrase came from, because what that means is somebody who is relying on their past successes. I won back then, and now I can rest on my laurels. The Nemean games, their wreaths were made out of wild celery. In the Olympic Games, they were olive leaves. Well, whatever the prize was, it was conferred on the champion at the end of the games, and it was done so with great solemnity and a lot of ceremony. But still, you think, well, is that all there is? Well, not quite. That's not just what they were racing for, because just like today, there was more. The victor was treated much like modern sports celebrities. When they went back home to the cities that they represented, they were treated as heroes because their success made their city feel more important. Typical thing of human nature. One historian wrote, "Everyone thronged to see and congratulate them. Their relations, friends, and countrymen, shedding tears of tenderness and joy, lifted them on their shoulders to show them to the crowd and held them up to the applause of the whole assembly, who strewed handfuls of flowers on them." It was their version of a ticker tape parade, I guess. Flowers being thrown. Another commentary notes that when they came home, they rode in a triumphal chariot. And in many cities, it says a sustenance was given to them out of the public treasury. They were exempted from taxes. It was common to receive benefits like having all of your meals paid for at public expense or getting front row seats at the theater or other public festivals. In other words, it's fame and fortune. This is what they were going for. I read the other day that the Olympic medals this year weigh 500 grams, the gold medals. The gold medals they're giving this year weigh 500 grams. Only 6 grams of that is gold because it's gold plating. The other 494 grams are silver, and it's worth monetarily about $564. So even that gold medal isn't worth a whole lot. But as one commentator said the other night on TV, if you are a gold medal winner in the gymnastics event, you will earn millions of dollars in endorsements. Millions. It's worth a lot. When Paul says that one receives the prize, what he is saying here is that we have a prize to pursue. We have a prize to pursue. And like they make efforts to obtain it, we have to as well. And there is only one approach to take to our calling. There's only one way to go about it, and that is to go all out and to lay everything on the line to win, because it is worth everything. Your benefit is going to be worth more than what you can imagine putting into it. And he's going to talk about striving for the crown. Make every effort as if only one is going to be able to get it. Now, who are we racing against? He's not saying, "Hey, Corinth, we're all in the church here and we're racing against each other and only one of you is going to make it to the kingdom." That's not what he was saying. We're not competing with each other, but we are competing against Satan and this world of his. And there's only going to be one winner. There will only be one winner when our race is over. So we need to run, he says, in such a way that you may obtain it. The stadium in which we run is the world. It's the world we live in. It's this present life. We are running now. We are running here and now. How are we running our race? Are we running after the right things? In verse 25, he says, "And everyone who competes for the prize," I'll stop right there. This is translated different ways. "Whoever strives in the games" is one translation. "Every man that strives for the mastery" is another translation. It's interesting, the word "competes" or "strives" in the Greek is agoned. Sorry, Mr. Johnson, you're going to cringe as I pronounce this. Agonizomi, something like that. There's a related verb, a common verb for the word contest was agon. A-G-O-N. Compete, strive, contest. We get our word agony from this Greek word competition, struggle, contest. Athletes who competed agonized in their efforts to win. Thayer's lexicon says this word is used different ways. It can mean to enter a contest, to contend in gymnastic games, to contend with adversaries, to fight. Metaphorically, to struggle with difficulties and dangers. or to endeavor with strenuous zeal. The same word is found in Luke 13:24 when it talks about one person came to Christ and says, Lord, are there few who are saved? And he said to them, strive. It's the same word. Agonize. Put everything into it to enter through the narrow gate. For I say to you, many will seek to enter and will not be able. There are a lot who want to do it, but they're not willing. They're not willing to compete. They're not willing to strive. So he said, everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. The margin in the New King James says, exercises self-control. Again, in context, Paul is using this as an athletic metaphor, and it's a great way to illustrate it. Because if there's one thing you learn by watching and observing world-class athletes, these are disciplined people. They cannot get to where they are without being greatly disciplined. Athletes have to control themselves. 4 years ago, Gabby Douglas, she's competing this year too, but she was the gold medal winner in several events in gymnastics. After the Olympics, she was talking about her gold medals. And she said, I just want people to know it took a lot. It took a lot of hard days in the gym and determination, passion, and drive. Gold medals are made out of sweat, blood, and tears, she said. And the effort in the gym every day and sacrificing a lot that you have to do. That was her take on it. Last week on the local news, they were interviewing some competitor, a lady somewhere in the Dallas area, who is competing in judo. And in interviewing her, she said, I practice 100 throws a day. Now, throw meaning you have an opponent and you're practicing how to throw them down. She said, I practice 100 throws a day, 6 days a week, every week, for 4 years. 600 throws a week, every week, for 4 years, so I can come here and make 4 throws in one day and win that gold medal. You look at that, you think, wow, that's a lot of dedication. That's self-control. Now he makes the point, they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable. How long does the crown last? What does it do? Again, if you've been watching, you might have seen an interview with Michael Phelps, the most decorated Olympian in history. I don't know how many he has by now. I think 25 as of yesterday, medals, 21 of them gold, over 4 Olympics. But in a personal interview with him last Sunday morning, he said after the London Olympics 4 years ago, he thought it was all over. And he said after that Olympics, he said, I was lost. He said, I found myself lost. I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. And he said, I just wanted to crawl into my room and not see anyone. You may be familiar, over the next couple of years, he got a couple of drunk driving citations. He was put in the public eye. He even said that he contemplated suicide. The most decorated, heroic man in the pool that has ever been, shortly after the Olympics, is contemplating suicide because he has nothing else. He found his way. He went into rehab. He said it was very interesting. In rehab one day, all of the people in rehab were sitting there watching the news, and it came up on the TV about his drunk driving. And he said all the heads turned and looked at him. That's you. He said, that's when you're hitting rock bottom. You're hitting rock bottom. But he, through rehab and counseling, he found a more sane approach to life and he reshaped his values. And I'm glad for him because no one wants to see anyone in that way. But the moral of the story is that, you know, the crowns of fame and honor and glory and money just perished in front of him as far as anything that was of lasting eternal value. Now, his was maybe an extreme situation, but it doesn't matter. Everybody is going to have, for those prizes, they're perishable. Paul is saying, put everything in perspective. Ultimately, what is the great value in being able to do something physically better than somebody else? In the long run. Is that what life is about? But we, an imperishable crown. He doesn't say here, we're trying to figure out what our crown is. He said, there are two kinds of crowns. We all want a crown of some sort. Every human does. And every one of us are striving after a crown. We're not here trying to decide it. We already are. All we have to do is look at life, and it'll tell you which crown we're striving after. Just look at life, and it'll tell you the crown that we're striving after. Our actions every day tell us where our priorities are, and our priorities tell us what our crown is that we're going after. It's very simple. It will either be physical or spiritual. Paul was saying to the church at Corinth, you can change your priorities. We have to start with what is your crown? Because understanding what your crown is going to define how you're going to live. And their eyes were on something very different. The track of life, brethren, that we're running on is lined with many crowns. They're called temptations. Lots of crowns out there to get. And a lot of them say, you can have me immediately. I'm not hard to get. There are a lot of things in life. Stop here. You can win this immediately. They're laid at our feet. Paul was pleading to the Corinthians to turn their backs on those things and set their eyes on the crown in the distance. Now, what is that crown? Keep your finger here. Go to James chapter 1, if you will. James 1. James 1 and verse 9. James was writing several, he approaches several times in this book the fact that there are people in different statuses of life in the church. The first that he addresses here are the lowly people and people who aren't so lowly in their living conditions in life. But he says, let the lowly brother glory in his exaltation. Now, what is the exaltation of the lowly? What is the exaltation of the lowly? In this particular case, he's contrasting it, verse 10, with the rich. And he said, but let the rich in his humiliation. In other words, glory in his humiliation. Whatever physical circumstance you're in, look at something that's more important and bigger. What is the humiliation of the rich? Well, it's talked about in the next phrase. Because as a flower of the field, he will pass away. The ultimate ending of everybody, regardless of our status in life, is we all die. And the race is over. And when the race is over, it doesn't matter what the status was previously. The exaltation of the lowly is given in verse 12. Blessed is the man who endures temptation. There's something very interesting about God's way of life in that he puts us all on a level playing field spiritually. The track to the kingdom of God does not favor anybody, any place in life. The track to the kingdom of God does not favor the poor over the rich, the rich over the poor, the male over female, black, white, yellow, any kind of racial issue. Being in God's kingdom is not dependent on any of those things, whether you're healthy or whether you're sick, whether you're married or whether you're single. It favors those who run their race with endurance. That's the issue. Those who run. Blessed is the man who endures temptation, who runs that course and fights that battle and lives according to the rules of a spiritual life. For when he has been proved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. The crown of life goes to the racer, the one who runs the trials with endurance. The word proved in Greek means to test or to prove, but it also has implicit in it with the expectation of approving. There's an expectation of approving. God expects us to be approved. When he called us, he expected us to be approved. He's called us with confidence, not in us, but in what he can do in us to run that race through his Spirit. There is an expectation of success. The crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. What is the promise? You might jot a note here in your margin, 1 John 2:25. 1 John 2:25, which says specifically, this is the promise that he has promised us. Eternal life. Eternal life. This is the exaltation of the lowly. This is the exaltation, the glory of the rich, of male, female, everybody. This is it. That's the crown. Back to 1 Corinthians 9 now, verse 26. Therefore, meaning based on what I've just said, as a result of what I've just said, we're running a race, we've got a prize, we're competing for this tremendous crown. Therefore, I run thus, not with uncertainty. Paul said, I'm not running like I don't know what I'm fighting for. I'm not running down the road going, I wonder where I'm going. He's not like Forrest Gump taking off to run across America and just reaches a point out in the desert where he says, I think I'll turn around and go back. Not knowing where he was going to begin with, just running. Paul's saying, I'm not exerting myself for nothing. I know what I'm aiming at. I've got my eyes fixed. I have the goal in mind, and I believe in God's promise. And there's nothing else in life that's worth pursuing in the same way. Not with uncertainty. Thus I fight. Now he brings in another game, boxing. They were very familiar with that. By drawing an analogy, by the way, he's not endorsing boxing any more than talking about spiritual battles endorses going to war, you know. But he is drawing on something that they could understand. Thus I fight, not as one who beats the air. That's an interesting phrase too, because in the language of the time, there are two ways this phrase can be understood. Boxers had a habit before a match of putting on a show. We would call it today shadow boxing. But they'd get up there and they'd punch, and they're just punching at the air. And it was sort of supposed to be an intimidating thing, a show of bravado. But in the Greek, the phrase was, they're fighting the air. They're fighting the air. It also meant something else, too. That in the match itself, when you have an opponent there, it referred to missing your target. That you could be throwing punches and not be hitting your target, and as a result, all that energy you're exerting isn't doing any good. It's just tiring you out. So Paul is saying here that that seems to be the main thing he's trying to convey. He said, I'm not missing my aim. I know what I'm fighting. I'm fighting hard. I'm trying to make every blow that I throw hit. I'm not going to waste my time on results that, on efforts that produce no result. What is our enemy? What is our enemy? Well, it's very clearly addressed in this book. It's sin, the desires of the flesh. The very next chapter, just a couple of verses down, he starts chapter 10 describing five things that caused Israel to be overthrown in the wilderness. And these five things are still five of the most common enemies that we have today. Have you ever seen people who just fought the air? As Christians, they were just They showed up, they went through the motions, but they just never seemed to connect to put down the enemies. A lot of effort without any results. Verse 27, he said, I discipline. But instead of beating the air, I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. The biggest test for us as Christians is not knowing the rules. It's having the discipline to abide by them. That is the biggest challenge. You can easily read articles about the disciplines that the Olympic athletes go through. Years of discipline, exercise, training to become an athlete at that level. They get psychological training, physiological, diet, nourishment, all sorts of training with teams of people helping them. They don't go it alone, and neither do we. We are in this environment where we have access to a lot of help and encouragement and counsel and wisdom and guidance. They have to be mentally tough. They have to be mentally tough to be away from their families, to be in strange environments, to juggle their schedules in order to meet the demands that this places on them. Why do they do it? Why do they do it? It all comes back to their vision and their motivation. They see something and they want it. Same thing for us. Same thing for us. Our view of life this way affects the way we live it. And that's why Paul was stressing this. It's no surprise, it shouldn't be a surprise, that he used these athletic events to make some very strong spiritual points. There have been times I read this and thought, you know, Paul was sort of like a coach. He was coaching the Corinthians. Yes, he was a minister. He was an apostle. But he was coaching them on how to live. He was teaching them and instructing them at times. And at other times, he was inspiring them. Sometimes he was prodding them. Sometimes he was trying to just lift their eyes up. And that's all involved in coaching. And he was giving them here a pep talk. But Paul was the best kind of coach, because he was saying here, I'm in the arena with you too. I'm doing this myself. He was a player coach, you might say. And he was so powerful in this that he was getting through to them, this is what I have to do, and you can do it too. Paul continued the athletic theme when he wrote to Timothy, and Timothy was another man he coached. Timothy was a young man, and Paul had him under his wing, and he was helping Timothy grow and develop. And in 1 Timothy chapter 4, let's look at a couple of things here. 1 Timothy 4, verse 7. 1 Timothy 4, 7. Paul says, reject profane and old wives' fables, and exercise yourself rather to godliness. For bodily exercise profits a little, but godliness is profitable for all things, having promise of the life that now is and that which is to come. The word exercise is another interesting Greek word, gymnazo. G-U-M-N-A-Z-O. Connecting the dots, it's the word that we get the English word gymnasium from. What is a gymnasium? It's the place where you go to exercise. It's the place where you go to play the games, to train. It's used in other places as well to convey this idea. Hebrews 5:14 says, solid food belongs to those who are of full age. That is, those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil. Isn't that interesting? What senses is he talking about? It's our spiritual senses. Those who have been working out spiritually. those who have been strengthening themselves or running that course spiritually, and they have exercised spiritual senses in the arena of discerning what is good and what is evil. That's very powerful. It's not people who are exercised just to learn a lot of knowledge. Knowledge is critical. We need knowledge. We have no lack of information today about God's word, and knowledge is essential. But just having knowledge doesn't win the race. It doesn't win the race. It doesn't win the spiritual battles. It's the exercise of discernment, knowing what is good, knowing what is evil, knowing how to apply the knowledge that we've got. That's where battles are won and lost. Hebrews 12:11 says, "No chastening for the moment seems joyful but painful. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained." Gymnazo. Same word. Those who have been trained by it. Life is like that. So he says here that bodily exercise profits a little, or as it can be rendered, it's profitable for a little time. It's not bad. We all need to do some physical exercise, maintain our bodies. But sooner or later, it's not going to keep you running forever. It only extends to a few benefits in life, whereas godliness is going to affect your whole life. He said it's profitable for the life, for eternal life ultimately, but also for the life that now is. It makes your life better now. Godliness makes your life better. And I think we're all living testimonies to that when we see that. In chapter 6, I won't go there, but in verses 11 and 12, he draws the analogy to boxing. He says, fight the good fight of faith. Fight it for that. Let's go to 2 Timothy chapter 2. In 2 Timothy 2 and verse 1, he says, "You therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus. And the things that you have heard from me among many witnesses, commit these to faithful men who will be able to teach others also." And then he offers three metaphors for us to think about. He offers the metaphor of a soldier, and of an athlete, and of a farmer. Now, I don't know if anybody in this room has ever been all three of these. If you've been a farmer, a soldier, and an athlete, maybe somebody has. Most of us have probably been one of them. We've had some degree of putting seeds in the plant, or in the ground at least, and watching them grow. I wouldn't call it farming necessarily, but there's a little bit of an analogy there. But we all are familiar with them, and we can all identify to a degree. And the common issue with all of these metaphors is the need to work hard in different ways for a major achievement, a goal. It's a fascinating study of each one of these, but I only have time, and I want to focus on this analogy of the athlete. He says in verse 5, "Also, if anyone competes in athletics, he is not crowned unless he competes according to the rules." This introduces something really broad in scope to consider. The athletes at the Olympic Games, before the game started, they swore before Zeus that they would compete according to the rules of the game. When we were baptized, we committed to God that we would compete according to the rules of life, His rules of life. We would follow the rules as well. It is an interesting concept, this thing of rules. Rules are just part of life, aren't they? We have rules of law that govern nature. We have rules that nations conduct themselves by. Every organization has rules. We have rules in our families. We have rules at work. We have rules in congregations. If you're new here, we have a rule. Well, it's not our rule, but it's a rule that we accept. You can't bring food and drink into this hall. Okay, it's not a bad rule. There have been times I wish I had a drink in this hall, but okay, that's the rule. Got to live by it. Why do we have rules? Well, rules are usually made to solve problems or to avoid problems or to make life consistent and fair and equitable for everybody. Those are usually the reasons for rules. Now, sometimes rule makers don't follow those principles, and when they don't, it creates other problems. But when the Proverbs 29:2 principle is employed, when the righteous are in authority, in other words, when those in authority make the right rules for the right reasons, people rejoice because it does create fairness and equity, harmony. Life works. The biggest, obviously most important rules are the rules of God. Those are the big ones. The rules of God, God's law, and they follow the same principles. They're for the same reasons. Not only do they define how to get along with him and how to get along with each other, but they provide consistency and equity and fairness to life. Everybody has to abide by the same rules. They even the playing field. Spiritual status in life is not different for one person than it is for another person. Some people don't have higher requirements or lesser requirements. The playing field is totally even. The rules of God don't favor the young or the old, strong or the weak. It gives us a consistency. They don't bend. People today are trying to bend God's rules. They've always tried that. They're really bending them now. And it's going to be a failed, horrible experiment. God's rules don't bend according to our gender or race or social status or income, education. And that's a great thing. We're all sitting here today going for the same thing by the same rules. Rule is an interesting word to study in the Bible. It's used in several different ways. I think the most challenging element about rules when you see some verses have to do with those where God talks about the need to rule yourself. Ruling your own spirit is used a couple of times in the book of Proverbs. Ruling oneself. There's an example in Colossians 3:15. It says, let the peace of God rule in your heart. What does that mean? We could think about that for a long time. Let the peace of God rule in your heart. That's a rule. Let the peace of God rule. Well, what does that mean? It's easy. We need to think about that to a great degree to think out, consider what that means. It means that the way we think, the way we speak, the way we react, to do it in such a way that is godly, that is lawful, that will maintain peace and respect and honor. There's a way that God wants us to rule our tongue, to rule the way we think, our hearts. We have to do that. We have to set rules for ourselves in a lot of life. Another interesting and challenging aspect of this concept of competing according to the rules. Anyone who competes has to compete according to the rules. Is the quest, it's this, the quest to overcome. All of us are on a quest to overcome something in life, aren't we? We're always working on ourselves. You know, in order to overcome, sometimes you have to set rules for yourself. Rules to fit the thing that you're trying to overcome. You're not setting them for somebody else. You're just saying, okay, I need to get a handle on this. I need to get up earlier in the morning. I'm going to make myself get up earlier because I tend to be a procrastinator. Whatever it is, you're setting a personal rule of life that you say, I want to live by this because if I can live by it, it's going to change my life. I can be a better person. We all have to do that. Not rules for anybody else, just ourselves. Over 5 years ago, there was a blog on the Kagwa member site that got a lot of attention. It was titled The Complaint-Free Challenge. I see some smiles. I know why you're smiling. The Complaint-Free Challenge. Now, what it was, it encouraged people to go for 21 days without complaining, criticizing, or gossiping. Go 21 and make it a rule. I'm not going to complain, criticize, or gossip. And it was based on the premise that we do a lot of those things. We complain, we criticize, we gossip a lot, and we don't realize to what extent we're doing it until we focus on it. Say, I'm going to focus on not doing it. Well, it's a good thing because doing so is obviously destructive and it pulls down people. So the blog made a very practical suggestion. It said, set a rule for yourselves to go for 21 days without doing it. And if you do, you have to start over. You have to start back at day one. The goal is to make it 21 straight days. And there's another premise behind it, that we are creatures of habit. And when you do something consistently, over and over, it tends to become more just a way of life. And we can change this. So I know a number of people who took that challenge. Some of you right here in this room, and some of you did it together. You know, let's work on this. And I'm not going to ask for a show of hands or how many finished it, but I remember hearing from time to time people saying, that was hard, but it was also good because I was really focused on living according to this rule. Now, Mr. Burnett did not get up here and say, okay, here's a law for the Dallas church. We're all going to do this, and you're going to start right now. Because it wasn't a rule he could set for the whole church. But it is a good rule that we can set individually. And life is full of those things where we set rules for ourselves. And it helps us. We compete according to the rules. It helps us run in the lane. It helps us run the right way. And if we're going to overcome, we will be following the rules of life, and God's rules must be followed for life to work well. He says in verse 7, consider what I say. Think about this. Consider what I say, and may the Lord give you understanding in all things. He said, think deeply about this. It's worth attention. Train in this way, and you'll get more understanding. So you see, Paul's using these athletic metaphors a lot, but I think his most powerful one is found in chapter 4. It was very powerful for Paul personally. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, in verse 6, Paul said, for I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. I know, he was saying, I'm on the downhill stretch of my life. I don't have a lot of time. But in verse 7, he said, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I've kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day. There's a day coming. I'm going to have that crown. And not only to me, but to all who love his appearing. That is solely what he was looking at. He said, I'm near the finish line, and he knew he wasn't going to quit now. You know, brethren, one of the privileges in life that we find is to be around somebody like that. When you have a chance to be around somebody like that, it's not a common thing to be around somebody toward the end of their lives and be thinking about that. 2 weeks from today will mark 35 years since my mother died. She was young, was premature. She was only 48 when her race ended. But cancer doesn't discriminate on age. She battled it for 19 months, and she far outlived the prognosis that she first got of 3 to 6 months is all that you have. And I remember a lot about that period of time. She was very courageous in so many ways. There were a lot of things that I remember so well. But one of the things that I most remember was the way that she ran the spiritual race. The spiritual race was just amazing to me. I'll give you one example. We had been told that she was failing and that we needed to get there. So Dee and I jumped in the car, and we quickly drove 900 miles from Jonesboro, Arkansas, out to Roswell, New Mexico, to spend as much time as we could. 4 days before she died, she asked my dad one day, she said, I want you to call this couple. There was another couple in the church there. She said, I want you to call them and ask them to come over. Dad said, well, okay, what for? She said, It's just something personal. He said, okay. So he called them, and after a while, they came over. So Sunday afternoon, and Mom said, I'd like to be alone with them. So Dee and my dad and I walked out, and they closed the bedroom door, and about 15 minutes later, they came out and said goodbye and got in their car and drove off. Dad went into the bedroom back there, and after a while, he asked my mom, he said, you mind telling me what that was all about? And she said, no. She said, I've just been thinking. I've been thinking a lot, and it crossed my mind that I think I might have offended them sometime back, and I wanted to fix it. I wanted to make it right before I died. And she said, I just asked them to come over so I could apologize if I'd done anything and make it right. You know, there was a person who was wasted away physically, could not get out of the bed, was down to skin and bones, about as frail in body as one could be. But boy, she was finishing the race strong. She was finishing the race about as strong as anybody can. She was pressing toward the finish line. She was not fading going down the home stretch. Not at all. You know, that's one of the amazing things about our spiritual race. The older you get, the weaker physically you get, the better you can perform spiritually. It's not a guarantee, but it is a possibility. And it's a probability for those who have lived their lives training, running that race in the right way. With age can come greater spiritual strength. It's a constant challenge, but it is encouraging to know, isn't it, that your spiritual well-being can still be going strong when you're physically wearing down. What a beautiful way God made us. What an inspiration that is to us. When your mortal body is not even capable of going any longer, we can still be peaking spiritually. You might remember in the introduction I said there's one more game they ran, that they played, that I was going to save. It was called Running with Armor. It was part of the Olympics. It was the last event that was added to the Olympic Games, and it was called the Hoplitodromos, or the Hoplite Game. It was introduced in 520 BC, and it was traditionally run as the last race of the Olympics. In that race, 25 runners would line up, and there were two lengths. One was about 400 yards, and the other was about 800 yards. And they were clad in full armor. They were clad in full armor. They carried a shield. They had metal shin guards and a helmet. And they had to run this race with armor that weighed 50 to 60 pounds. You're carrying 50 to 60 pounds of armor, and you're running 400 yards, 800 yards. And the race was to illustrate the speed and the stamina that you need for warfare. There are drawings and pictures of people running who have fallen, who are stumbling over others who had already fallen. It was based on the war tactics of soldiers running in full armor at the enemy. I wonder if that's what Paul had in mind when he wrote Ephesians 6, where he talked about putting on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. And he said, we don't wrestle against flesh and blood. Our race is against something else. And he said, take the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. My mom was able to do that. I've seen other people able to do that, run in full armor spiritually and finish strong. It's so important. I've got a couple of minutes left. Some of you may be thinking, isn't this the weekend where they're supposed to be talking to the FI students about, you know, onward and upward? That's what I've been doing. I haven't mentioned FI, but I didn't want to particularly because I wanted everybody to consider this. But yeah, let me talk to you who come here for FI. Let me add one more thing for you to think about along this theme. one of the most important elements to bring to the race. I said earlier that Paul was like a coach. The Corinthian church was a young church, sort of like a young person. Young and energetic, a lot of potential, but still with a lot to learn, a lot of things to overcome. Paul wrote a second letter, and what was so interesting in that second letter was that it showed that they had taken to heart what he said in the first letter. The second letter was overall very encouraging, and they had displayed one of the most important traits of being able to compete and win, and that is the Corinthians were coachable. They were coachable. They were teachable. That should be a no-brainer, right? Isn't the whole point of coming to FI to be coached, to be trained, to learn? Well, it is, but life tells us, every one of you who've ever been an athletic coach can also tell this too, that on the field of athletics, some people just aren't very coachable. It's also in the field of spiritual athletics too. We have found it in the spiritual arena. We have found it over the decades with the church's educational programs. It makes a huge difference. One time I was at a summer camp. There were four or five boys out in the field kicking around a couple of footballs. I walked over there and I asked them, hey, do you want to learn how to kick a spiral? And they all said, yeah. And there is a technique to it. So they listened to them and they started trying. They didn't have any success. I knew they wouldn't at first. It takes practice. After a couple of tries, one of them said, you know, I liked it. I like doing it my way. I like kicking it the way I always kick it, which was holding the ball sideways, you know. And I said, okay, you know, if that's the way you're going to be. He went back to messing around with it like he was before. And the others kept working at it. And in a little while, one of the kids did it. All of a sudden, it came off their foot, and you see this beautiful spiral, and it's going higher and farther than they'd ever kicked it before. And he was so excited, and the rest of them started working at it. And sooner or later, they started succeeding. And meanwhile, the one guy who had quit and didn't want to do it that way was watching. But now he had two difficulties to face. One of them was he hadn't learned how to kick a spiral, but the second one was now he was going to have to overcome his pride and be able to swallow it and come back and say, maybe I made a mistake. Can you teach me? Well, he never did. He wasn't coachable. He just wasn't coachable. Now, kicking a football is not a big deal. Kicking a bad habit is. And we all need coaching. Now, how did I know how to kick a spiral? Because when I was 11 years old, one day I was in the pasture beside our house kicking a football, and my neighbor, who had been a punter in college, came out and said, hey, you want to learn how to kick a spiral? And I worked at it and worked at it, and he coached me. I'd been through the same thing years before at their age. But you have to be a learner before you can be a coach. But if you're not coachable, you're going to struggle to learn. It's a mindset. Well, I was talking with one applicant this year at the faculty interview. I asked, why do you want to come here anyway? And he said, you know, I was talking with one of my friends who was in FI last year, and I asked him the same thing. Why should I come there? And he put it to me very simply. He said, FI set me up for life. FI set me up for life. The knowledge can do that, but only if you're coachable. The classes you're going to take are not your race. That's not the race. The race is out there. It's out there in life. But those classes can give you the knowledge of how to live. Those are the coaching sessions, if you're coachable. That's what Solomon meant when he told his son in Proverbs, hear, my son, receive my sayings. I have taught you in the way of wisdom. I have led you in the right paths. When you walk, your steps will not be hindered, and when you run, you will not stumble, if you're coachable. Now, that's not just for FI. It's for all of us, obviously. Well, I know in this audience there are probably sports junkies who love the Olympics, and there are probably in this audience plenty of you who can't stand sports and zip right by it. And events like the Olympics offer not much interest. But I hope that we will take the time to realize that these things are more than just athletic events. They offer lessons of life with which we can all identify. Brethren, we're in a race. It's the greatest race of all. It's a serious race, but it's a race that can be won. We're all in it together. We need to run it with joy. We need to run it with dedication and confidence. And like many who have gone before us, finish strong.